Christmas Eve, 2002, Port Allen, Louisiana. After leaving home on a long drive to visit her husband in prison, 65-year-old Mary Ann Fowler stops off at a strip mall to purchase some food from a Subway sandwich shop. When she walks back into the parking lot, Mary Ann vanishes without a trace, and surveillance footage shows that she was abducted by the driver of a pickup truck. Months later, serial killer Derek Todd Lee is arrested after being linked to the murders of multiple women, but while there's evidence to suggest he could have been responsible for Mary Ann's abduction, investigators cannot conclusively link him to the crime, and Mary Ann's body is never found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering an horrific unsolved abduction, the 2002 disappearance of Mary Ann Fowler. Since we've entered the month of December and are edging ever so closer to Christmas, our podcast is going to spend the next 2 weeks covering some cold cases which took place around the holidays. This particular case was suggested to me last year by a listener from Louisiana named Cody, so I thought now would be an ideal time to cover it. Before she went missing, Mary Ann Fowler was best known for being the husband of Louisiana's former elections commissioner, who wound up going to prison after he became embroiled in a major scandal involving bribery and fraud. Mary Ann was planning to visit her incarcerated husband for Christmas, but before she arrived, she would stop off at a strip mall to purchase food and was abducted from the parking lot. At the time, Louisiana was in the midst of being terrorized by an assailant nicknamed the Baton Rouge serial killer, who was responsible for the murders of several women before he was identified as a suspect named Derek Todd Lee and arrested 5 months later. Lee was eventually sent to death row, and while Mary Ann Fowler was older than Lee's other known victims, investigators explored the possibility that he could have also been responsible for her abduction. Indeed, there was some compelling evidence to suggest he was the perpetrator, but there just wasn't a smoking gun to conclusively link him to the crime. Since Mary Ann's body has still never been found, it remains up for debate whether or not she fell prey to the Baton Rouge serial killer, so we're going to explore that possibility on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. Oh, and I also have one more quick reminder. By popular demand, The Trail Went Cold is going to be closing off 2020 with another special Q&A episode, much like the one we released 2 years ago, where you can send me questions about myself and the podcast, and I will record my answers for the episode. If you would still like to send in some questions, but haven't already done so, please send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Q&A, to robin.warder@icloud.com. The deadline for receiving questions is next Wednesday, December the 16th. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the disappearance of Mary Ann Fowler.
Thank you.
Our story begins in Louisiana in 2002, and our central figure is 65-year-old Mary Ann Fowler, who lives in Baton Rouge and is currently married to her 62-year-old husband, Jerry Fowler. This is the second marriage for both of them, and Mary Ann has an adult son from her previous marriage named John Pritchett, as well as two granddaughters. She has spent much of her career working in the field of education, holding such positions as the Assistant Superintendent of Research and Development with the Louisiana Department of Education, and she now works as an education consultant. For decades, her husband's family was a political dynasty in Louisiana, as Jerry Fowler's father was the state's elections commissioner for 20 years before Jerry himself was elected to the position in 1979. Jerry would also hold the office for 20 years before losing the primary in 1999, but he would soon find himself embroiled in a major scandal once it was discovered that he had been using his position as elections commissioner to accept kickbacks from contractors who produced voting machines. Jerry had also been committing income tax evasion, and it was estimated that he had defrauded the state of Louisiana of approximately $3 million, much of which he spent on gambling. In November of 2000, Jerry agreed to plead guilty to the charges of malfeasance and conspiracy to commit money laundering, as well as two federal counts of filing false tax returns. In exchange, he received a 5-year prison sentence that would be served at the Federal Correctional Institution in Beaumont, Texas. In spite of this, Mary Ann continued to stand by her husband and often made the 3-hour commute from Baton Rouge to Beaumont in order to visit him. On Christmas Eve, Mary Ann left her home in her Mazda sedan to begin a holiday trip to see Jerry. She was planning to drive to Lake Charles in order to spend the night with family before traveling to Beaumont to visit her husband on Christmas Day. After crossing the Mississippi River and entering West Baton Rouge Parish, Mary Ann decided to exit the interstate onto Louisiana Highway 415 to stop at a strip mall in Port Allen. After parking her vehicle, she went inside a Subway sandwich shop to purchase food and exited the establishment between 5:30 and 5:40 p.m. Sometime later, the two Subway employees noticed that Mary Ann's Mazda was still in the parking lot outside, so they decided to go out and take a closer look. They discovered that Mary Ann's purse, keys, and the food she had purchased were lying on the ground in an open parking spot next to her vehicle, and the contents of her purse had scattered everywhere. Some of Mary Ann's false fingernails were also on the pavement, which suggested she had been involved in a violent struggle before she was abducted. The West Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff's Office were quickly summoned to the scene and discovered some tire tracks in the parking lot which may have belonged to the vehicle used to abduct Mary Ann. Since some wrapped Christmas presents, which Mary Ann had been planning to give to her husband, were still in the back seat of her car and her purse was on the ground, it appeared that robbery was not the motive for the crime. There were no witnesses from the strip mall who reported seeing or hearing the abduction, but investigators would eventually obtain some black and white surveillance footage from a security camera inside a liquor and tobacco store located 2 doors down from Subway. The camera was on a constant rotation and would capture a view of the parking lot through the front windows every 55 seconds. While it was partially obscured by the building's awning, the spot where Mary Ann's Mazda had been parked was visible, so the footage would be sent to the FBI for enhancement and analysis. They were able to make out what appeared to be the grill for a dark-colored 1994 or 1995 Chevrolet pickup truck parked next to the Mazda, but most disturbingly, it was now apparent that the camera had captured snippets of Mary Ann's abduction. At one point, Mary Ann could be seen walking up towards her car before a man grabbed her from behind. The camera then rotated away from the windows, but when it returned, it showed this man climbing into the pickup truck before speeding away. Unfortunately, the only part of the abductor which was visible on the footage was the back of his head, so it was impossible to make an identification. The authorities launched a massive search effort which lasted 12 days and covered over 500 miles, but they failed to turn up any trace of Mary Ann. After learning about his wife's disappearance, Jerry Fowler's attorneys lobbied for a furlough so he could be released from prison and help participate in the search effort, but their request was denied. Investigators did look into the possibility that Marianne's abduction could have been connected to her husband's past criminal activities, but they found nothing to suggest this was the case, and since no one phoned in any demands, it seemed very unlikely it was a ransom kidnapping. Well, right from the outset, there was speculation that Marianne was the victim of an unidentified individual who had been terrorizing the area and would become known as the Baton Rouge serial killer. In fact, on the very same day Marianne was abducted, it was publicly announced that DNA evidence had just linked the killer to his fourth victim. At this point, the killer's first confirmed victim was 39-year-old Gina Wilson Green, who had been raped and strangled to death inside her Baton Rouge home in September of 2001. DNA testing would eventually link this crime to two more murders in Baton Rouge. 23-year-old Louisiana State University student Charlotte Murray Pace, who was raped and stabbed to death inside a residence in May of 2002, and 44-year-old Pamela Kinnamore, who disappeared from her home in July of that year, before her body was discovered underneath the Whiskey Bay Bridge 4 days later, where she had been raped and had her throat slit. On November the 21st, 23-year-old Trenisha Danae Colombe went to visit her mother's grave in the town of Grand Coteau, but vanished after parking her car outside the cemetery. 3 days later, her body was discovered in a wooded area, and it turned out that she had been raped and beaten to death. On Christmas Eve, it was announced that DNA testing showed that the same person responsible for killing Trenisha had also committed the previous three murders. On March the 3rd, 2003, the Baton Rouge serial killer would claim another victim when 26-year-old Carrie Lynn Yoder vanished from her apartment and remained a missing person for the next 10 days. Much like Pamela Kinnamore, Carrie's body would be discovered underneath the Whiskey Bay Bridge. She had been raped, beaten, and strangled to death, and DNA evidence would show that the same perpetrator was responsible. But within the next 2 months, a suspect would emerge from the investigation into an unsolved missing persons case in the nearby town of Zachary. On April the 18th, 1998, 28-year-old Randy McBrewer disappeared from her home after an apparent abduction in the middle of the night. Randy's 3-year-old son had slept through the whole thing and went to a neighbor the following morning to report that his mother was missing. While Randy's body was never found, there was enough blood at the scene to indicate that foul play had taken place, and semen containing unidentified male DNA was on a trash can liner at the residence. The case remained cold for 5 years, until a detective with the East Feliciana Parish Sheriff's Office passed along a tip to an investigator with the Attorney General's Office, which involved a 34-year-old person of interest named Derek Todd Lee, who lived in the town of St. Francisville and had allegedly once told an acquaintance that he was involved in Randy McBrewer's disappearance. It turned out that Lee had a prior criminal history for such offenses as burglary and stalking, so the investigator decided to question Lee about the case and obtained a court order to collect a sample of Lee's DNA. Well, sure enough, not only was it a match to the DNA found in Randy McBrewer's residence, but it also linked Lee to the murders of Gina Wilson Green, Charlotte Murray Pace, Pamela Kinnamore, Trenisha Danae Colombe, and Carrie Lynn Yoder. By the time the match was made, Lee had already fled the area, but he would be captured in Atlanta on May the 27th and extradited back to Louisiana. Within a month, DNA testing would conclusively link Lee to another unsolved crime, the murder of 21-year-old Geraldine DeSoto, who was stabbed to death inside her home in the town of Addis on January the 14th, 2002. It turned out that Lee was also responsible for the attempted murder of another female victim, which took place on July 9th of that year, when he entered the mobile home of a woman named Diane Alexander and attempted to rape, beat, and strangle her to death with a telephone cord. The only reason Diane wound up surviving is because her son just happened to return home at that moment, forcing Lee to flee the scene. In August of 2004, Lee would stand trial for the death of Geraldine DeSoto, But since she was not sexually assaulted, the district attorney only elected to charge him with second-degree murder, believing that a conviction for first-degree murder would be harder to obtain. Nevertheless, the jury found Lee guilty of the crime, and he received a sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. 2 months later, Lee stood trial for the rape and murder of Charlotte Murray Pace and was once again found guilty, but this time, he was sentenced to death via lethal injection and would be transferred to death row at the Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola. Even though Lee had been conclusively linked to 7 murders, investigators suspected that he may have had additional victims and explored the possibility that he was responsible for the disappearance of Mary Ann Fowler. Well, in December of 2002, Lee was driving a maroon-colored 1994 Chevrolet pickup truck, which resembled the truck seen in the surveillance footage at the scene of Mary Ann's abduction, and it turned out that Lee had sold it only days after investigators publicly announced that they were searching for a truck matching that description. A search of Lee's cell phone records would place him in the general area of the crime on Christmas Eve, as he made a call at 5:20 p.m., which pinged off a cell tower in the village of Grosse Tête, located just 14 miles outside Port Allen. Lee also did not have an alibi during this time period, as his wife Jackie and their 2 children returned to their home in St. Francisville that night and were surprised to discover that he was not there. Lee never phoned his wife to let her know where he was, and he had still not returned home by the time she went to bed at 11 o'clock. Jackie claimed she never saw him until she briefly woke up between 4 and 5 a.m. and noticed he was now in bed beside her. However, all attempts to link Lee to the crime were unsuccessful. The presence of Mary Ann's false fingernails at the scene seemed to indicate that she put up a violent struggle against her abductor, but disappointingly, the nails did not contain any traces of male DNA. The pickup truck Lee had sold in the weeks following the abduction was recovered and given extensive forensic testing at the State Police Crime Lab, but they failed to turn up any physical evidence which could link the truck to Mary Ann's case. Since the truck's new owner worked in construction and often loaded mortar and sand in there, this might have ruined any chances of obtaining usable DNA. In May of 2004, Mary Ann's surviving family had her declared legally deceased, and after spending 4 years in a Beaumont prison, Jerry Fowler was allowed to serve the last year of his sentence at a halfway house in Baton Rouge before he became a free man again. Following his release, one of the first things Jerry did was organize a memorial service for his missing wife, but Jerry himself would pass away of heart failure in January of 2009 at the age of 68. As for Derek Todd Lee, West Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff Mike Kaz claimed that he visited him on death row with hopes of convincing him to reveal the location of Mary Ann's body. Even though Sheriff Kaz assured him that he would not be prosecuted for the crime, Lee refused to admit any involvement and even went so far as to throw a temper tantrum when he was asked about it. In the end, Lee's execution never went through, as on January the 21st, 2016, he wound up succumbing to heart disease at the age of 47. In spite of this, investigators have stated that Mary Ann Fowler's case is not closed, but after nearly 18 years, she continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So it's crazy to think that this story begins with an entire subplot involving a political scandal, which likely had nothing to do with the case. You have an elections commissioner from a very respected family who had been a political dynasty in the area for decades until he committed serious fraud and went to prison. I mean, given all the drama surrounding elections these days, accepting bribes from voting machine contractors is a pretty big deal. But in spite of Jerry Fowler's legal troubles, I get the impression that Mary Ann continues to remain a very respected woman in the community, So it's a pretty cruel twist of fate that she would become the victim of a violent abduction while leaving on a road trip to visit her husband in prison. It really does not seem like Jerry's legal issues played any role in Marianne's disappearance, as she may very well have been a completely random victim who was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. I certainly do not believe this was an attempted ransom kidnapping, because no demands ever came in, and it was well publicized that following his incarceration, Jerry filed for bankruptcy because he owed around $1.68 million to a number of creditors, including the IRS. Needless to say, kidnapping the wife of a disgraced, bankrupt man serving time in prison is not the most lucrative plan to make money. There's zero doubt that Marianne was abducted from the strip mall parking lot moments after purchasing food at Subway. As you recall, Marianne was planning to make a 130-mile drive from Baton Rouge to Lake Charles in order to spend Christmas Eve with family, but unless she was being followed, I'm not sure how anyone could have predicted that she would get off the interstate and stop at this particular strip mall in Port Allen. So this makes me wonder if the perpetrator was already waiting there in the parking lot, and once Marianne arrived, he set his eyes on her and decided to stage an abduction. If that's what happened, then this was an incredibly brazen crime, and the abductor got very lucky that no witnesses saw or heard anything, and the one security camera in the area was just far enough away not to catch a clear glimpse of him on the footage. It's very reminiscent of the security camera footage in the Jennifer Kessie case, which captured a man parking her car around the time period she went missing, but his face just happened to be obscured by some fencing, so he has never been identified. In fact, I don't believe they ever officially clarified if the footage in this case was clear enough to determine if the suspect was white or black, which would obviously be very important since Derek Todd Lee was African American. Marianne had previously taken self-defense courses and was known for being in great physical shape, so the presence of her fake fingernails in the parking lot suggests that she attempted to put up a fight against her attacker, and it's a miracle he managed to get away undetected. Of course, the big unanswered question in this case is whether or not Marianne fell prey to one of the worst serial killers of the modern era. 2002 was a pretty terrifying time in Baton Rouge and the surrounding area because everyone knew there was a serial killer on the loose who had already claimed the lives of multiple women, and at this point, no one had any clue about his identity. If you look at the earliest news coverage of Marianne's disappearance, there was immediate speculation that she had become the victim of the Baton Rouge serial killer, though the authorities would not confirm that without more conclusive evidence. Interestingly enough, the early reports also mention alleged eyewitness sightings of a white pickup truck speeding away from the scene, but investigators were not yet certain if this truck had any connection to the crime. Indeed, the surveillance footage from the liquor and tobacco store would later show that the truck driven by Marianne's abductor was dark-colored rather than white. One of the biggest criticisms of the investigation into the Baton Rouge serial killer is that the authorities initially put a lot of emphasis on eyewitness sightings of a white male driving a white pickup truck, which was supposedly seen near one of the murder scenes, and the FBI also put together an offender profile, which suggested that the perpetrator was white. But of course, since Derek Todd Lee turned out to be black, this meant investigators wasted a lot of time searching in the wrong direction. So I have to wonder if these reported sightings of a white pickup truck at Marianne's abduction scene were the result of the hysteria surrounding the case at that time. Officially, DNA evidence has linked Derek Todd Lee to the murders of 7 women, but there has always been suspicion that he was responsible for more crimes. Marianne's son, John Pritchett, has publicly expressed his belief that Lee abducted and murdered his mother, but here's an odd coincidence which links these two men together. In March of 2004, John was arrested for felony theft after stealing his ex-wife's $6,000 engagement ring, removing the diamond, and then trading it in for another diamond to give to his current fiancé. While John wound up being taken to the West Baton Rouge Parish Jail in Port Allen, And it turned out that Lee was being held there at the exact same time for an upcoming court hearing, though I do not believe their paths actually crossed. On the day she went missing, John had a heated phone conversation with his mother over her decision to travel to Texas to visit his stepfather in prison for the holidays rather than spend Christmas with him. And John has always been haunted by the fact that this turned out to be the final interaction they had with each other. Now, even after Lee was sent to death row for one of his murders, he never did admit to any involvement in Mary Ann's disappearance. Once they've reached the point where they've got nothing left to lose, it's not uncommon for serial killers to toy with law enforcement, whether it be remaining silent about crimes they committed, or falsely confessing to other crimes which they had nothing to do with. Lee's situation is interesting, because not only did he refuse to discuss Mary Ann's case, but he apparently flat out threw a temper tantrum when asked about it. It's worth noting that even though Lee's DNA was found at the scene where Randy Mabruer was abducted in 1998, he never did reveal the location of her body, and she's technically still a missing person, so Lee never struck me as someone who would confess to crimes he was never officially charged with. And of course, since Lee died of natural causes before he could be executed, he may have taken some secrets to his grave. But before we talk any more about his connections to Mary Ann Fowler, I want to briefly discuss some other cold cases in which Lee was looked at as a potential suspect. It's possible that Lee's first murder actually took place all the way back in August of 1992, when 41-year-old Connie Warner was abducted from her home in Zachary before her body was found just over 1 week later. Connie had been beaten to death and suffered a skull fracture, but what was significant is that her home was located just one block away from the residence where Randy Mabruer would be abducted from nearly 6 years later, and a man matching Lee's description was reportedly seen watching Connie's house shortly before she disappeared. Unfortunately, since Hurricane Andrew swept through the area during the time period Connie was missing, it washed away all potential physical evidence from her body, which is why Lee has never been conclusively linked to her murder. Lee was also a potential suspect in the murder of a 23-year-old woman named Christina Moore, which I'll talk more about momentarily, but perhaps the most unusual cold case Lee has been associated with is the unsolved disappearance of 67-year-old Glenn Tankersley, who vanished from Lee's hometown of St. Francisville on December the 5th, 2002. There's very little information available about this case, and while there's no real evidence implicating Lee, he knew Glenn personally and would take him for rides in his car. But obviously, targeting male victims was not Lee's usual MO. However, I thought the disappearance was worth mentioning since it took place less than 3 weeks before Mary Ann's abduction. At 65 years old, Mary Ann was older than Lee's typical victims, as the ages of the women he murdered ranged from their early 20s to mid-40s. So if by chance, Lee decided to change his MO by murdering a 67-year-old man, who's to say he wouldn't then decide to go after a 65-year-old woman? Also, the murder of Trenicia Dene Colom, which took place in November of 2002, was also different from Lee's typical MO. All of his other known crimes involved him attacking or abducting women from inside their homes, but Trenicia was abducted after parking her car on a road near a cemetery. This could be seen as an indication that Lee was becoming a lot more brazen, which is why he decided to abduct Mary Ann from the parking lot of a strip mall during business hours 1 month later. I have to wonder if there's any significance to the fact that it was publicly announced on Christmas Eve that DNA evidence from Trenicia's murder had been linked to three of the other murders he had committed. Could this announcement have set Lee off and compelled him to commit another murder that same day? Perhaps the murder of Trenicia was an attempt to change his MO and throw off police and send them down the wrong track, but he became frustrated once it was announced that the crime had been linked to him. In fact, that could explain why Lee decided to go to the trouble of disposing of Mary Ann's body. Other than the murder of Randy Mabruer, Lee never exerted much effort to get rid of his victims' bodies, as he would either leave them inside their residence or dump them in a spot where they were relatively easy to find. Yet if he was responsible for killing Mary Ann, Lee decided to dispose of her body so thoroughly that she has not been found in nearly 18 years. I wonder if the announcement about the DNA findings compelled Lee to take the extra step of ensuring that DNA evidence could be linked to this particular crime. Indeed, it's easy to believe that Lee might have spent a lot of time covering up what he did that night because he never returned home until the wee hours of the morning, or bothered to phone his wife to let her know where he was, even though it was Christmas Eve and they had kids. So let's look at the timeline. We know that at the very least, Lee did pass through West Baton Rouge Parish during the approximate time period Mary Ann went missing, because he made a call on his cell phone at 5:20 p.m., which pinged off a cell tower located about 14 miles away from Port Allen. Theoretically, Lee would have had enough time to arrive at the strip mall before Mary Ann was abducted 15 to 20 minutes later. However, one detail which is particularly interesting is that the next call placed from Lee's cell phone took place at 11:20 p.m. and was picked up by a cell tower in St. Gabriel, located just outside Baton Rouge in Iberville Parish. And remember how I just mentioned the unsolved murder of a woman named Christina Moore? Well, on May the 23rd, 2002, Christina vanished while jogging along River Road in Baton Rouge and would remain a missing person for nearly a month before her remains were discovered in a ravine next to the Greater Ebenezer Baptist Church, which is located on River Road in Iberville Parish. Christina's cause of death was blunt force trauma to the skull, and since the location she went missing from was in close proximity to the residence where Charlotte Murray Pace was murdered 8 days later, Lee was looked at as a suspect. But unfortunately, since Christina's remains had been exposed to the elements for so long, there was no available physical evidence which could conclusively link them to the crime. The most significant point is that the cell tower which picked up Lee's phone call on Christmas Eve was only a few miles away from the spot where Christina's remains were found. This led to speculation that Lee could have disposed of Mary Ann's body in this same area, but while a search effort failed to turn up any trace of her, they did find a copy of a book which Mary Ann was known to have owned. As far as I can tell, no one was able to determine what Lee would have been doing in Iberville Parish on Christmas Eve, and his whereabouts during the six-hour window between his two cell phone calls have never been accounted for. It also seems like a convenient coincidence that Lee made the decision to sell off his Chevrolet pickup truck only a few days after the police publicly provided a description of the truck which was used to abduct Mary Ann. It's reminiscent of the episode I released a few weeks ago about the unsolved disappearance of Erica Baker, where rumors spread that she was killed in a hit-and-run accident involving a van, and the prime suspect wound up selling his van only a few weeks after she originally went missing. So if Lee was responsible for Mary Ann's abduction, it seems likely that they just happened to be in that strip mall parking lot at the same time, and she was a completely random victim. But if that's what happened, why did Lee decide to abduct her at that particular time? After all, Christmas Eve seems like a really unusual time to commit murder, especially when you have a wife and two children waiting for you at home. Well, even though Mary Ann was 65 years old, if you look at photographs of her, she definitely looks much younger and could easily have passed off as being in her mid to late 40s, so I wouldn't let her age disqualify her as being one of Lee's potential victims. But the detail I find particularly interesting is that Mary Ann just happens to bear a striking resemblance to Lynn Marino, the mother of one of Lee's other victims, Pamela Kinnamore. The murder of her daughter would turn Lynn into a major victims' rights advocate who would become one of the biggest driving forces of the investigation to find the Baton Rouge serial killer. She would hold rallies on the steps of the Louisiana State Capitol, campaign for additional funding for DNA testing, and did interviews on a number of high-profile TV shows. She pretty much became the voice for all the victims' families, and if Lee followed all the media coverage of his murders, he definitely would have become familiar with Lynn Marino and known what she looked like. This is why I've always been intrigued by the possibility that Marianne could have been a victim of mistaken identity. If Lee stopped at the strip mall and happened to see Marianne from a distance, he could have mistaken her for Lynn Marino, who was also in her mid-60s at that point, but looked younger. Knowing that Lynn was constantly spreading awareness about his crimes and pressuring the police to catch him, Lee may have made the spontaneous decision to abduct her after she exited the subway, but it turned out she was the wrong woman. The whole theory is based on nothing more than pure speculation, but if Lee was the perpetrator, this provides a potential explanation for why he would elect to commit an abduction at that specific location when there was a huge risk of him getting caught. When you look at the situation as a whole, there really isn't a smoking gun to conclusively prove that Lee was responsible for Marianne's disappearance, but there is a compelling circumstantial case against him. If additional evidence had surfaced over the years which pointed towards an alternate suspect, that would be one thing, but everything they do have seems to point to Lee. If someone else did commit this crime, then the real perpetrator got incredibly lucky that an infamous serial killer just happened to be driving a similar pickup truck through the same area around the same time, and would get captured only a few months later to steal all their attention away. But if Lee was the guilty party, then I guess Marianne's family can at least take comfort in knowing that he was not a free man for much longer, and justice was ultimately served. But since he never admitted to the crime before he passed away, I'm sure it's also a huge source of frustration that they might never be able to recover Marianne's body. It's always sad when a missing or murdered person is believed to be an unconfirmed victim of a notorious serial killer, because while it's possible that the right guy did get put away, you'll always have this nagging feeling in the back of your mind that the real killer managed to get away with it. In this particular case, I'm relatively certain that Derek Todd Lee was the right guy, but regardless, if you happen to have any information about the disappearance of Marianne Fowler, or the location where her remains might be, please contact the West Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff's Office at 225-343-9234. That's 225-343-9234. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. And once again, if you would like to send in a question for our upcoming Q&A episode, you may also email it to robin.warder@icloud.com under the subject line Trail Went Cold Q&A, and the deadline is next Wednesday, December the 16th. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about a final appeal segment from Unsolved Mysteries, which covered the controversial conviction of Paul Farrell for the murder of Kathy Ford, a victim whose body has still never been found. And for our patrons in tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to announce that next year, provided that it becomes safe to travel again, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at two separate CrimeCon events. The regular CrimeCon, which takes place at the Fairmont Hotel in Austin, Texas from June 4th to the 6th, and the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London the following weekend on June the 12th and 13th, and is the ultimate true crime weekend, partnered with Crime and Investigation. If you would like to purchase tickets to either event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount, and it applies to both the Austin and London events. So to receive 10% off, either visit crimecon.com or crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Rob D, Kenny F, Linda M., Chris H., Dash R., Damian N., and Tracy K. Thank you all so much for your support. And I also just wanted to mention that this coming Saturday, December the 12th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, we will be having another Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch Marathon, in which we screen classic segments from the TV show, and you can chat with myself and your fellow listeners. We've got a link to our screening room for this event in our show notes and pinned to the top of our social media pages, so be sure to check there for more information, and we hope to see you there on Saturday. In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes of every episode, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I also just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join us next Wednesday for our final Christmas-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold.